We're going to talk about parenting your adult children. And before I begin, let's join together in prayer. Our Father in heaven, we thank you that as adults we are your children and that you love us and care for us. We thank you for your model of fatherhood. And we pray that you would, as we talk about this subject now, look solely to your word, which is fully sufficient for every challenge we face in life. And even if some may be here today concerned about particular situations of difficulty and confusion, we pray that you would give wisdom, you would give confidence. And Lord, we pray for our sons and daughters that you might, especially for those who are yet wayward and do not know you, that you might draw them to yourself. We ask this in Jesus' name. Amen. Several years ago, when I was preaching in our church, I think from Ephesians, about parenting, I made a statement, well, when your kids are out of the house, you're finally done being a parent. I didn't intend it to be funny. My kids were still small. I didn't know any better. And there was an older man named Elmer who came up to me, and his kids are about my age, and he said, "Jim, you never stop being a parent." And another example is there was an article in our local newspaper about a lady who was celebrating her 105th birthday, and the article said she remains extremely close to her kids, who are 74 and 75. And she said, "While they're not kids anymore, they are to me," she said. And so, another thing I've learned over the last several years, I've really been thinking about the subject a lot, is that when you go like downstairs and you see all the books on counseling, or you go to Christian bookstores or even online, it's like a pyramid where if you talk about raising little kids, there's a lot of books we can recommend. You know, Ted Tripp, Shepherding a Child's Heart, Bruce Ray, who's here, and Withhold Not Correct. If they become teenagers, there are still a few books we can recommend. You know, the Age of Opportunity, hopefully our book. But there's virtually nothing, especially from a biblical point of view, about these problems. And I've had a desire for the last few years, actually, to write a book on this subject to fill that gap, and have been working on material, and you're going to be guinea pigs a little bit for me. Hopefully, actually this summer, Lisa and I have already signed a contract with Presbyterian Reformed to write this book, which is supposed to be out hopefully by this time next year, on parenting your adult kids. And another thing that the Lord has been kind in His providence, there are still seats here, there. When I counsel with IBCD, I don't really get to pick the cases that come to us. It's interesting to see what the Lord sends, but it just seems like I've had, especially in the last year, a huge number of cases of families involved in conflicts and difficulties with young adults. Sometimes young adults living at home, sometimes in marriage situations where the daughter's marrying against the parents' will, or the young couple is having nothing to do with the grandparents. And so I've had the opportunity to learn quite a bit. Now, there's a lot of material in your notes, and I'm going to go fast through some parts of it and more carefully through other parts. And I beg your indulgence and your patience with me on that. And first, which I want to cover fairly quickly, is what can we do to prepare our children for adulthood? So this is your young adult, you know, still at home, not on his own yet. The goal of parenting is to make your children ready to live wisely on their own in the world. And really, the entire book of Proverbs is written exactly for this purpose. The second book project on which I've worked is a book about Proverbs, and I've been so blessed to see that it's really a manual for a young man or a young woman about to leave the home and go into adult life on their own, and preparing them for that. And so, you know, we as parents need to realize that childhood is a temporary condition, that our children are going to grow up and leave. It's our job as parents to train our kids when they're at home, but a time is coming when they're going to be off on their own. And this is hard for many parents. We homeschooled. And I think, you know, people often homeschool because they want to control the influences on their kids. They're hoping to control outcomes in terms of the kind of adults they become. But you've been accustomed to having, and when they're babies, you have absolute control. They only go where you carry them. They sleep when you tell them to sleep. They eat when you tell them to eat. And you have a lot of control through their education, through their younger years. And as they reach adulthood, you're about to lose control. And I find that many parents aren't prepared for that. Sometimes kids aren't prepared for that. Parents need, as their children grow older, to learn to treat them as adults and to respect their adulthood. And sometimes you think, well, there's not all that much to respect in terms of their character or their behavior, but you still have to respect them as adults. In the same way that if you had a neighbor or, you know, the child of a friend who was an adult, you wouldn't talk down to them as if they were little kids. You have to engage them as the adults that they are. Also to try to learn to see the world through their eyes. One big challenge also is to, as you relate to them adults, is to make a relationship in which it can be safe for them to tell you what they really think. And in, you know, Proverbs 20 verse 5 says, the thoughts of a man's heart are like a deep well, and a man of understanding is able to draw them out. And I think many times our adult, young adult children are afraid to tell us what they really think, if they may think that they don't share our faith, or they don't share our views on different issues. Maybe they think that fornication is okay before marriage. They may have views we don't like, and they say, well, if I tell my mother what I really think, I'm just going to get blasted with an earful, and bad things are going to happen to me. And we need to learn that there's a difference between our responsibility, perhaps, to control their behavior if they're still living in the house. But we can't control their ideas anyway. We can't control their hearts, and it's better that there's an open dialogue taking place than to scare them into submission until they can finally gather up sufficient means to get away. Another very important principle, this may be the most valuable thing some of you get from the whole session, is don't nag. Ask yourself this question when you're about to speak to your young adult. Do they already know what you're about to say? Have they already heard it before? And if so, it's probably unnecessary and annoying. Now, if you have a young adult living at home, you really have a choice. You can either, there's kind of three levels of things, and we talk about this in the Good Kids, Bad Choices book as well. There are, this is how I would like for you to live. I'd like you to, you know, go to law school, go, you know, take over Ken Sandy's ministry when he retires. You know, whatever dream you have for your young adult, you know, I want you to, you know, marry a missionary or whatever the dream is. Then there's the you can't live here and do this standard. You know, if you're going to stay out all night with your boyfriend and do drugs and be a sluggard, you got to go. Even then, words aren't very effective. Actions need to take place to deal with that bottom category rather than nagging. But there's a middle category where they have freedom as young adults. And if you've given them that freedom, then you really can't nag them about it. What I see parents doing a lot that's really destructive is they're giving their children freedom in terms of their entertainment choices or their sleeping times or aspects of their life. But then the parents are just drip, 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 drip saying, well, you know, why don't you do this? Or they have expectations that, well, why aren't you more helpful? Well, it's either you say a condition of living here is you do these jobs, in which case, actually, they respond reasonably well to that typically. But if you get mad because they didn't figure out the heart's desires that you have, and then you start nagging them because they didn't read your mind to know that you're tired of carrying in 9 bags of groceries on your own, you think any considered individual would realize that, and you get your feelings hurt. Again, you have an option. You can either come in and say, help me bring in the groceries. And if you don't like it, leave. Or you bear with the fact that if they don't notice, they're selfish and they're immature, but nagging is not going to make them any more mature. Nagging is destructive. What we're trying to do is teach our kids to be ready to live on their own. And this is really, again, the summary of the book of Proverbs. Ultimately, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, teaching them to live for God and for His glory, learning to put others ahead of themselves. Young adults are extremely self-centered, apart from the grace of God. And they need to learn to put God first and others second. One Al Mohler writing about this talks about how some see delayed adulthood is a new social phenomenon which allows self-centered Americans even more time to focus on themselves while not being responsible for anything else or anyone else. They need to be taught to pursue a vocation. They want a vacation. Life is a vacation, yeah. If I wasn't a biblical counselor, I'd say there was a Freudian slip. But the book of Proverbs teaches that effort times skill produces success. You know, that the hands of the diligent makes rich. That's the more hours and the harder you work, the more successful you are. He who is skilled will stand before kings. So it's not just working hard. If you work hard 50 hours a week doing daycare, you're going to make less than $500 a week. If you work hard 50 hours a week as an engineer, you're going to make $5,000, which is the better option. So, teach them wisdom concerning vocation and financial wisdom in general in terms of the foolishness of debt and to beware of get-rich-quick schemes instead of God's way of becoming wealthy. To teach them God's principles for marriage and purity, and to warn them. So much of Proverbs, 5, 6, and 7, is warning against immorality and the destructiveness of immorality. Now, their strong desire sexually, I think, is given them by God to motivate them to, for a young man especially, mature, get skills, get trained, get a job so you can support a family, for a woman to mature and to grow, to be able to be a wife and a helper. So, I mean, those desires, I think, positively, you know, if a man realizes that the only way those desires are going to be fulfilled are within the covenant of marriage, with him taking responsibility and working hard, that is a motivator, which I don't think is an ungodly motivator. I think it's an appropriate motivator for him. Many Christian kids who are walking with the Lord tend to marry young, and they also tend to get through college fast and other such things because of that. Wisdom in choosing companions, resisting temptation, not fearing man. When is a child ready to leave home? Ideally you want to see all those characteristics of Proverbs ripening. But many children leave too soon, don't they? I think they're kind of too extreme. Some leave too soon and some leave too late. We'll talk about the too lates in a minute. But many kids want complete freedom before they're ready for freedom. And they haven't developed the skills. I mean, it's kind of an irony where I've seen many young women who didn't like living at home under their parents' authority. So what do they do to get away? They get married to be under the authority of a husband who isn't as mature as her parents. And what do guys sometimes do? They join the Marines because they don't want to be under authority. They're tired of their parents telling them what to do. Now, sometimes kids leave too soon because their parents are controlling, domineering, and nagging and not respecting the fact that they're turning into an adult. And they're escaping a bad home. Now, what authority do we have over our adult kids? We need to realize that it's different from small kids. And a lot of verses I have in your outline, a lot of this is going to be developed in the book in terms of the Bible recognizes a difference between childhood and being an adult. When I was a child, I spoke like a child, I thought like a child, then I became a man. I put away childish ways. Our children are becoming men and women and not to be treated as children. I think one way that parents provoke their children to anger is to treat them as if they're small children. Again, as someone who homeschooled his kids and loves homeschooling, confessing problems within the movement of which I was a part for many, many years, is that I think many homeschoolers don't know the difference between what to expect in terms of compliance of a 9-year-old and a 19-year-old. And that provokes the 19-year-old to anger and frustration, and they will either outwardly conform until they can get away, or they'll rebel right under your roof. And we need to learn to be letting go, which includes letting our children make choices that we don't fully agree with, so long as they're not in the disaster category. Now, obviously, when your child is married, they leave father and mother and are joined to their spouse, become one flesh. What's more complicated is the status of single adults. And this is something I've been working on quite a bit, just reading through the Bible. What does the Bible say about this? And a couple things have helped me here. There's this little passage in Numbers when the spies had gone into the land, remember, and the nation followed the unbelieving spies, and Joshua and Caleb, had said, we can go. It's interesting here, it says, none of the men who came out of Egypt from 20 years old and above shall see the land I swore to give Abraham, Isaac, and to Jacob, because they have not wholly followed me. So based on that verse, if your son is 21, and you want to follow the 10 unbelieving spies, what should he do? He should go against his parents, and God holds him responsible, not just to do whatever his family did, but as an adult who needs to speak for himself, he should have followed the spies. Otherwise, the believing spies, otherwise he dies in the wilderness with them. Another passage interesting in John 9, when the blind man is healed, in verse 21, when they go to his parents, remember what the parents said? Ask him, for he is of age. So there's that idea that when you reach adulthood, you're not under your parents' authority the way you were before. Jesus, in John chapter 2, we're told in Luke that he continued in his childhood under his parents, earthly parents, Mary and Joseph. But when he begins his ministry in John 2 and Mary starts to tell him what to do, he's pretty blunt with her. What to me and to you, woman? Meaning no longer do we have that relationship. He was a single adult male and he did not have to obey her in all things as he had before. In 1 Samuel, you have Jonathan going against his father Saul and being loyal to David. And that was a righteous thing for him to do. So in adulthood, Paul, apparently being unmarried, was independent. Galatians talks about that the heir is treated as a child under authority until he becomes an adult. I've seen very sad stories. I've seen men in their 40s whose mothers told them, sometimes because they'd been to a certain seminar, that you still have to obey me because the man in his 40s is not yet married, and so you must still obey me. And so that she determines his education decisions, his career decisions, his romantic decisions. And I think that is a horrible abuse of the fifth commandment. The authority does not extend that far. Now, having said that, if your child is living under your roof, you have expectations. You have the right to expectations because they are still dependent upon you. And what should you do? What do you do when your adult children come home, or they never leave? There was an article in Time magazine a few years ago called The Phenomenon of the Twixters Between Childhood and Adulthood. And this has been a lot of in secular literature, and it's backed up with statistics. How many, a much higher percentage of the population in their 20s, instead of getting married, moving out, being on their own, are still living with their parents in their old bedrooms, and the parents paying for things. There was a movie, A Failure to Launch, about that. There are different names, and some people call it the Peter Pan syndrome. They never want to grow up. The Australians call them boomerang kids. You throw them out and they keep coming back. But the percentage of children in their 20s still living with parents has gone up radically. And sociologists talk about a whole new phase of life in the same way that maybe even aspects of childhood and adolescence became part of culture in the 19th and 20th centuries, when now you have adolescence, where you have an extended childhood. And John Piper has written about this. Al Mohler has written about this as well among Christians. And the big problem with the kids in their 20s, 30s even, still living at home, is they want all the privileges of adulthood with very few of the responsibilities. They want the freedom to run their own lives without having to provide for themselves. If the parents try to put restrictions or rules, they become angry and manipulative. I'm not a child anymore. But they still want their laundry done, their food paid for, their cell phone, their car insurance, etc. So are there valid reasons? Yes, there are, biblically. I think, you know, for a young man, for example, could be a young lady as well, and, you know, he's completing his education for his parents in his young adulthood to let him stay home or continue to help him, with the goal being that he'll soon be able to provide for himself and a family. Great. You know, establishing a business, saving for marriage. And the big issue is there's a goal there. It's not just kind of a perpetual, just kind of making enough money to get by and hanging out at home. But, you know, there's a mission to this. A daughter may choose to live at home wanting to remain under the protection of her parents, even if she's working or otherwise, as if she's waiting for possibly marriage. Some kids are not able to take care of themselves because of physical or mental disabilities, and you have adults living at home permanently, more or less. Sometimes it's the other way around, and an adult child chooses to live at home because the parents are not able to take care of themselves, and that's a very noble thing to do. So there can be extraordinary circumstances, but bottom line for me is that there should be a reason. And the reason isn't just because it's easy. There has to be a reason that's a godly reason. There needs to be a plan so that, you know, hopefully they'll be able to move out. The plans of the diligent lead to advantage, Proverbs 21:5. And the problem with the twixters is there's a deliberate postponement of the responsibilities of adulthood. And you see people failing to establish a career. Time magazine article said they're reaping the fruit of decades of American affluence and social liberalism. They're more fun-oriented than career and marriage-oriented. And so, you know, college used to be a time for those who chose to go to college. I mean, you graduate from high school, I guess one of two things happen. One is you learn a vocation, an apprenticeship, or you get in and you learn a trade, and you can make money at that, and people with trades make a lot more money than a lot of college graduates right now. So that's one valid option. The other option would be you go to college so you can, again, get a degree. And when the 4 years are up, and it's 4 years or so, not four or five, not seven or eight or nine, that you'd be transitioning to adulthood. But now you go, especially like to the local community colleges, and you'll see people there in their 30s who still haven't decided what they want to be when they grow up. And you have this lifestyle of living at home, and they work enough to pay for movie tickets, Starbucks, and maybe if they have to pay gasoline, while they're eating the food and getting whatever else they can out of their parents. You know, the one sociologist sees the period from 18 to 25 as kind of a sandbox. A chance to build castles and kick them down, experimenting with different careers, knowing that none of it really counts. After all, this is a world of overwhelming choice. Now, the proverb says, what you do when you're a young man counts a lot. By his deeds, a young man distinguishes himself. And so, you know, oftentimes, the years go by, and you know, you see someone, you know, that doesn't have skill that's worth more than minimum wage, even though they're going through their 20s into their 30s. They haven't got a career option. Oftentimes they're looking for easy money, looking for some scheme where, okay, well, you know, they don't want to work hard. So, you know, the warnings in Proverbs about, you know, get-rich-quick schemes, that you're just going to come to poverty. And it's through tilling your land, it's through hard work with skill that you make money. But how can I make a lot of money and still maintain my Starbucks lifestyle? And they want others to take care of their financial needs, which the Proverbs talks about sluggards. But the proverb also says a worker's appetite works for him, for his hunger urges him on. And if somebody's giving you food, then you don't have the appetite that motivates you to work. Financial irresponsibility. I am astounded at the amount of debt that some young adults have rung up on. And What astounds me more, though, is you'll see a young adult, a guy who's working part-time at minimum wage, and he's 28 years old, and he's got $25,000 of credit card debt. But you know what astounds me more than that? What do you think? The parents pay it off! Again and again! And you know what? Someday you'll have to pay us back. Right? You might as well put it into the will. Because you're not going to see it otherwise. One marketing consultant, speaking of the 20-something, says, Mom and Dad subsidize them, so they are major consumers, spending their income on non-essentials. Game Boys, flat-screen TVs, iPods, exotic vacations, fashion, eating out. Their needs are taken care of by Mom and Dad, so their income is largely discretionary. They're living at home, but if you look, you'll see a flat-screen TV in the bedroom, brand-new car in the driveway. Advertisers have a real stake in keeping them in a tractable, exploitable pre-adult state, living at home, spending their money on toys. You know, if you're 20-something, has more leisure time, sees more movies, watches more TV, eats out more often than you, something's wrong, isn't it? They put a high value on relationships and entertainment. Proverbs 14:23 says, in all labor there is profit, but mere talk leads only to poverty. They consider it to be kind of a moral thing, that I'm better than you because I value friendships, and I spend lots of time with my friends, and we hang out, you know, all through the night and talk about really important things together while you're sleeping because you have to get up early in the morning to go to work. Work kind of gets in the way, and you'll hear them say, well, I can't take a job that's going to interfere with my lifestyle. And then they trade marriage and commitment for uncommitted relationships and fornication. The way they're avoiding marriage, you know, the age for the first marriage, just since I got married almost 30 years ago, has gone up several years, both for men and for women. And it's not because people are waiting to have sex, it's because they're not waiting. That if you can get sex without marriage, then the incentive to marry diminishes. And it seemed to be too restrictive to many people. Time magazine writes, the fact they're marrying later means they have more sexual partners than any previous generations. Of course, they don't even realize that that's wrong in many cases. Now, interestingly enough, there was something I saw, a survey that I think saw both in The Economist and Kiplinger's, is that there was a survey done showing that married men make over 25% more per year than single men. And they took out other, you know, factors, that marriage itself seemed to be the defining factor that motivated the guy to greater success. Sadly, parents contribute to the problem. They fail to prepare the children to be on their own. Some refuse to let go of their kids. They're nice to have around. Actually, when they were teenagers, they were a real pain. They were in your face. And now they're kind of sweet. They just kind of hang out, and you know they're pleasant, and you don't want to be alone. Sometimes there's not enough of marriage left in the house where the parents are afraid if the kids leave, what's going to be left? They're afraid to be home alone without kids, and so the parents wind up financing, which is enabling sinful behavior. They give them money and resources and prevent them from taking responsibility so that these kids perpetuate their childhood and don't grow up. Sometimes it's out of guilt where, and they're good at guilting you, where they'll, hey, you have lots of money and lots of stuff. I don't have much money. If I had a lot of money, I'd share it with you. So why don't you share it with me? And there's no idea of the fact, well, yeah, I got up at 6 this morning, and I got back at 6 tonight, and that's not really relevant. If you were nice, if you were kind, and even as a parent, you want to be generous, you love your child, and so you'll tend to think, well, I'm just being generous to give her the new car, and to pay her cell phone bill, and to pay for her insurance, and to pay off his credit card, and to pay for her tickets, and on it goes. They're fearful of taking strong steps to deal with their kids. You know, who's the classic bad parent in the Bible? Eli, right? Remember, he had his sons who were doing all kinds of wickedness. Something that, you know, Eli was not a parent of toddlers when the Bible talks about him, right? Because his sons were having sex with the women in the holy area and, I mean, getting drunk. This was not little kids. Eli was a failed parent of adult kids. And Eli's guilt was that he failed to control them. He couldn't spank them. But what was his sin? That they were in the family priest business, right? And he had them working and doing the sacrifices. And as they were stealing, and you know, they were dishonoring God and by not doing the sacrifices according to the law of God. They were stealing the meat for themselves rather than giving it to those who offered it and offering it to the Lord. They were committing immorality. Eli failed to stop it. Now, did Eli nag his sons? Yes, he did. There's several verses recorded in 1 Samuel 2 of him saying, "My sons, it is not a good thing that you're doing this." And, you know, he whined at them, like so many parents of adult kids do. But he didn't say, "Stop. You're fired. You can't go to the tabernacle anymore. And you've got to find a new way to make a living. I can't tolerate this any further." And in 1 Samuel 2:29, when God gives his condemnation of Eli, he says that you honored your sons above me. And that is a summary of the failure of parents of adult kids. Meaning, you're more concerned about pleasing your sons than you're concerned about pleasing God. And you don't want. And see, it's selfish. Parents don't want to kick their kids out. They're afraid. Well, if I kick him out, he won't survive. He won't go to church anymore. She'll become on the street. She'll be homeless. They'll embellish those possibilities when you threaten. And so, you know, if I take a hard stand, I'll lose them. Simply enabling. Some birds need to be pushed out of the nest. Now, even in a good situation, there are challenges. Maybe your adult's living at home, your adult child's living at home, and they should be at home, but it's still a challenge when you're in this in-between stage. Child wants to be treated like an adult. Parents struggle. And I think especially moms, as they have had this intense relationship with them as children, it's really hard to see their little darling as an adult who needs to be, you know, and somebody else's 21-year-old daughter or son, you could relate to as an adult. When it's your own child, you're still about 9 years behind reality in the way you're treating them, and it's hurting the relationship. Now, because they're still under your roof, they're not yet fully adults in every way. They still are subject to your rules. And, you know, one thing is, if they were renting a room from a friend, they'd still have to follow some rules. You couldn't leave all your stuff. You know, if you rented a room from a guy with an apartment, he's not going to let you leave your shoes and your clothes and your underwear all over his house. He's not going to do your laundry for you either, I don't expect. So you have the right to some expectations, but also the rules have to be reasonable and should recognize their adulthood. And God was able to summarize with 10 into the Old Covenant, 2 into the New Covenant. And I think they need to be as clear as possible, but also giving a lot of freedom. Instead of saying at 2 p.m. every Saturday, you must mow the grass, simply to say by 6 p.m. on Sunday, the grass must be mowed. And you can figure out when you want to do that between Thursday and Saturday, but not micromanaging. You must work at least 50 hours a week, either at school, in a job, or helping at home. Now, but I'm not going to come tuck you in at 11 and make sure. If your 50 hours encompass you staying up till 1 in the morning, as long as you don't make noise which disturbs others, and you get up at 9 or whatever, as long as you're doing it, again, you're an adult, you need to work out how you get this done. My requirement is that you work. And when and how you accomplish that, you need to figure out. So you can tell your 12-year-old when to go to bed, and probably you should. Where it becomes an issue with your 22-year-old is when the door slams or they set off the smoke alarm or something at 5 in the morning. You need to think in terms of helping them to grow up, to encourage them to grow in maturity, to work towards independence, to have the courage to make tough choices. you may need to seek their forgiveness for having spoiled them and enabled them. Positively, when they come home, that may be a last hope you have to train them right. You know, if a child leaves and comes back, and sometimes they come back because you're the only port in the storm. They didn't come back because they love you and they're sorry that they left badly. They came back because there's nobody else who will take them anymore. But when Proverbs 19 says, discipline your son while there is hope, there's still hope. But as they come home, expectations need to be made clear, along with consequences. You want to also show love. You know, Ken was talking about the balance between kind of the rules and the compassion, and you've got to have both going on in balance. The husband and wife have to be united about this. Showing love is not giving them lots of money and stuff so they never have to learn how to take care of themselves. But you can do special things for them and be kind to them in other ways. What do you expect of an adult child living at home? Well, I've already said, one, you're going to work as hard. If you want to live here and where we are working to provide this place for you, you need to work as hard as the other adults in the house. I see these situations, I've done so many of these cases where you get a mom and a dad who both work all day long while the kid's just kind of hanging out playing Nintendo or something. I don't know what he's doing all day. And then they get home and the mom cooks dinner. I don't know what the dad's doing, but the mom cooks dinner. Then she does the laundry and does the shopping on weekends. That's insane. If you're going to live here, you want to be an adult, you need to take the responsibility. You cannot be lazy and live under our roof. You have to live according to financial responsibility. Don't lend them money. Don't bail them out of their financial foolishness. Adults have to take care of this. I assume most of us, if we did something really foolish, of course the government maybe now is the one, right? You do really stupid things in debt, the government will bail you out. That's a bad model in my opinion. They need to learn to take responsibility for themselves. Demand sexual purity. If you're going to live at home, fornicators and adulterers, God will judge. If you want to live that way, then you need to go somewhere else. I can't stop you from doing that. But if you're going to live in our house, you have to agree no drunkenness, no substance abuse, no immorality. And if you don't do it, again, nagging does not work. Nagging is an utter failure. Proverbs 26:3 is a bit for the horse, a bridle for the donkey, and a rod for the back of a fool. Point being, that's one of my favorite verses for young adults. A bit for the horse, a bridle for the donkey, and a rod for the back of a fool. That if you have a donkey, and the donkey doesn't want to do its job, you want him to carry something up a hill? If you say, Mr. Donkey, it makes me feel so bad when you don't carry this up a hill. Hey, it just breaks my heart. I loved you. I've taken care of you since you were a little donkey. And I just can't believe it. What does Mr. Donkey think? He don't care. Actually, Mr. Donkey's kind of happy because he knows he has power now over you. That he knows someday he may do some token little thing and it's going to thrill you so much you'll give way more than you should. What does Mr. Donkey understand? He understands the whip. He understands consequences. That's back to what I said earlier. Don't nag. Do something. What they understand is, I've just locked down the internet, and you don't have the password. That car belongs to me. Give me the keys. You know, you have 2 weeks to get a job, or you need to leave. Whatever it may be, that these are the expectations and you need to meet the expectations or this is what happens to you. Nagging and whining does not have any impact. You have to be willing to do the ultimate. I'm not saying the first time you have trouble, kick them out. But if they fundamentally don't want to follow your rules, that's the only option I believe that you have. Okay, what do you do when your adult children get into trouble? I'm going to buzz through this section. Elise and I wrote a whole book about that, dealing with teens, but the same things apply, called When Good Kids Make Bad Choices, and this is really kind of overviewing some of that material. I'll tell you what you do when they get in trouble. One sentence. You let them experience the consequences of their folly rather than bailing them out. If you bail them out, they're just learning that there are no consequences to foolishness. You are an enabler, and you think you're loving them, but you're actually destroying them. The consequences of poverty or fines or prison or whatever they've gotten into is what God has designed, hopefully, to get their attention. Like I read the verse before, that it's hunger that makes a laborer work. If someone will not work, neither let him eat. Let them do without. Oh, but all my friends are going on this trip and I just need $400 more. I'll pay you back. Sorry. Or, well, I don't have any money to pay my car insurance. And that's, by the way, they always try to export their problem to you and make it your problem. Well, how much did you spend at Starbucks this month? How much did you spend on entertainment? How much did that new iPhone cost you? You know, I'm still using the phone from 4 years ago that is falling apart. You know, that you've spent your money irresponsibly, so you don't have the money to fulfill your responsibility. That's your problem. But they'll come to you and say, we have a problem. And then they'll say, no, you have a problem. Back to you. You've got to help me. I can't. I'm helpless. What are we going to do? I'll help you as a young adult to face the consequences of what you've done. But if you bail them out, that's a teaching moment. And, you know, excuse me. Young adults can be manipulative and very charming. Manipulative is they put it back on you, but they have learned to sing the song you like to hear. You know, I think the Lord is really talking to me right now, they say. That, you know, I realize I've made a lot of mistakes, and I'm going to get a job, and I'm going to start working harder. But now can I have the $500? Don't be talked into it. You're hurting them. Even if you feel guilty for your failures, giving them money is not going to make them better, is it? So, and then the ultimate is some have to be kicked out. When should you give financial help to your grown children? Well, first you should do it very carefully. Because finances cause all kinds of trouble in relationships. Because you help one and you didn't help the others. But there can be times, okay? Your child is pursuing an education which is going to give them the ability to take care of themselves and a family. I think that could be a wise investment if they're responsible. Your children who have been responsible and, your young son, daughter-in-law, they have a baby, he's got a good job, and they're thinking about buying a house. If you want to give them part of their inheritance and give them some money for a down payment with absolutely no strings attached, it doesn't mean down payment as a contract saying now we get Christmas and Thanksgiving for the next 10 years. It has to be without strings. It may be a time, but you want to help responsible, godly children with your money, not pour your money down the toilet of irresponsible, ungodly children who will just keep coming back for more and more and more. Okay, next area I want to talk about, which is very important, it's probably the last major we'll have time for, is how do we deal with our kids as they approach courtship and marriage? Again, part of the homeschool movement is there's a lot of teaching about courtship. I really believe courtship is a great thing. I actually was taught courtship 33 years ago, and probably one of the few people that long ago who practiced that, and it's worked really well. I'm really thankful. But you hear that, and you, when your kids are small, you start praying for the person they're going to marry, and when they're little, you teach them, and you give the girl a promise ring, and this ideal that of the parents being involved, where you know, the young man should come to the father and say, may I court your daughter? And the young man, you know, he's a fine young man. You love his family and he's on his way to a good career. And, you know, he's respectful and all these wonderful things. And so you have this dream that, you know, that you're gonna walk your virgin daughter down to meet this young man who is, you know, he's gonna live two blocks away, and, you know, they're gonna be in the same church with you, and it's all just gonna be wonderful. You're gonna be there helping your daughter raise your grandchildren. We don't always get what we dream. And some parents try to control that. And they make a mess out of their kids and their relationships. Now, I think kids are very wise, both our sons and our daughters, to seek the wisdom of parents. Parents can see problems and faults and the person, the people our kids are interested in romantically that they can't see. And young people often fall in love for the wrong reason, charm and beauty rather than the fear of God. It's nice if we all agree about everything and we all agree on the wedding date and the place and talk about conflict. You could do a whole seminar just on wedding planning and probably need 2 or 3 hours. But we don't always get what is ideal, do we? And in this area, we have to give our dreams to God. Because lots of Christian parents don't get what I just described, do we? Our kids sometimes marry in ways or even live together or do things that really grieve us. And then what do? Well, do we as parents have authority to tell our children whom to marry? I don't think so. I think ideally they should seek our blessing and our approval. That's wise. But if you don't have your child's trust, if you don't have your child's heart, by the time they're a young adult, they're not going to ask you anyway. It's not something you can control by force. Again, you can control a 5-year-old and make him eat his broccoli. But if a 21-year-old girl wants to get married, you putting your foot down ain't going to stop her. If there's a relationship of love and trust, you'll be listened to. And I've counseled in cases where parents have been concerned about the person that their child was interested in. And the parents, I think, acted so wisely that they said, look, this is your choice. And here's what we see. But if you choose this guy, then we're going to try to make it work with you. And we're going to help you. But here's some concerns we have. But they respect that it's her choice. The parents just say, I forbid you to ever see that person again. It drives them away. You need to have their heart. And you know, to give a 12-year-old girl a ring and she promises that she'll never marry unless her daddy approves of the man, I think that's a nice concept. But it's also hard to hold a 25-year-old to a promise she made when she was 12. She may see the world in an entirely different way now, and I don't think it's gracious to pound on her and try to guilt her into backing down. Parents do not have a right to impose a particular person on their children. And I've been interested in the Bible. There are a couple passages I'll just mention briefly. In 1 Corinthians 7:39, it talks about a woman whose, I think, spouse has died. And it says, she is free to marry whom she will, but only in the Lord. It doesn't say whom her father will or her brothers will. She chooses. Even more remarkably, and this is one I just stumbled upon. This is a nice thing about reading through the Bible and you're thinking about something. You find these things you have never seen before. But in Numbers 36, you have a situation about the daughters of Zelophehad. Numbers 36:6. And Moses says, let them marry whom they wish. But they must marry within the tribe of their father. But and you know, if they didn't marry within the tribe, then there would be a loss of inheritance. But we can't impose it. Some parents marry to escape bad parental authority. I think parents can provoke their children to anger by micromanagement. Numbers 36:6 in 1 Corinthians 7:39. Now, you know, you say, well, under what circumstances may a child go against parental wishes when marrying? I've been in a few cases over the last few years in which parents objected and tried to work that through with them. And this is where all the peacemaking stuff is so practical and so relevant. You know, getting both sides to confess their sins and their faults, that is hard to do. But you can see where, you know, the gal has interest in this guy, and he's a believer, but they're both so immature. And instead of respecting the parent, they've been in the face of the parents about it, and they've been arrogant. But the parents also have been controlling and harsh, and neither side wants to see their own sin and fault, and trying to help them to get the log out of their own eye. There are some cases where you have to say, you know, this is wrong. You're marrying an unbeliever. You say you're a believer. This is wrong. You should not do that. Again, you can't stop them from doing it because you don't have the authority anymore. You don't have the power anymore. You may think you have the authority. The example I gave before, there was a 42-year-old man whose mother, really, because he lived alone with her, she didn't want him to get married. And so any girl he was interested in, she nixed and said, well, you have to obey me. Fifth commandment, Exodus 20. Finally, I convinced him he was 42, he was free to marry. And he's now got a bunch of kids and is doing real well. And the mothers have learned to live with it. But not with them. I've faced cases in which, it was one case where a guy tried to do it right, and he was courting this young lady, and then the father realized that the young man is a 5-point Calvinist, and the father's a 6-point Arminian. And by this time, this couple had already become very close. They were on the verge of engagement. And the father said, this man, I don't like his doctrine. You can't see him anymore. I forbid you to talk to him anymore. She's 25 years old. He's abusing his authority as a father. There's no biblical basis. And I would say that even if the guy was an Arminian, she was a Calvinist. So it goes both ways. There's not a biblical reason that he has to be so authoritarian and angry, and he refuses to go to the wedding. And and that's what often happens too. Is I've seen these cases where sometimes it's just a young couple, and the parents said, "I think you ought to wait another 6 months. I think you wait out in the year." And when they don't do it, then we're not coming to the wedding. And then the attitude is, until they come to us and confess how wrong they were and how guilty they were, we're going to have nothing to do with them. We'll shun them. And I actually attended a meeting one time. There's a certain seminar where these extra-biblical ideas of parental authority are taught. And there was a room full of people, and there was a family that I knew that asked me to come to this meeting because it was kind of like an AA confrontation or something where you had like 6 or 7 couples, and they all walked in holding, not the Bible, but holding a little folder from the seminar that they go to. And they were quoting from that, And saying that because this couple, their child was about to marry another believer, but her parents didn't like the timing and didn't like this happening. And the couple that I knew was going to go to the wedding. They were saying, I think you're not too young. I'm not sure you're ready. But if this is what you're going to do, we're going to go to the wedding, try to support you. And all these other families were there to kind of get them to come, turn around, and to shun their kids like they had all. But the saddest thing is they went around and they were telling their stories. And there were their half dozen couples who said, yeah, well, I stood my ground and I did the right thing and I've not talked to my kids for 6 years. I've suffered for righteousness. And it broke my heart. And I'm so thankful that the couple I was there with said, well, we're not going to do that. There's nothing in the Bible that requires me to shun my child because I don't agree with their choice. We're to love our enemies. And, even if it's wrong, even if you don't like what they've done, God calls you to be gracious. And by the way, they know you don't like it, okay? You don't have to tell them one more time. If you have reservations about the young man or the young lady, you've probably communicated that more than was necessary. And if this is the person with whom you may have to interact for the rest of your life, and this person is going to be a gatekeeper to your grandchildren, do you really want to alienate them? Do you really want to create a war that you can't win? You're free to love people who have sinned against you. You're free to pursue peace. As far as it is possible with you to be at peace with all men. Now, there are tough things. I can't deal with all those in detail. But, if your child is living with someone out of wedlock, they know you disapprove. If they come to your house, they have to sleep in separate rooms because they're not married. But I don't think it's wrong for your unbelieving child, and I assume that's what they are, or they should have been disciplined, and they're counted as an unbeliever, for you to love that person and even to get to know the person they care about and be nice to them. There's nothing in the Bible that says you have to treat them all like dirt. Now, you have your standards, and they have to understand that. And I've found, actually, that unbelieving couples from Christian families understand, okay, we're going to go stay with my parents, and we have to be in separate rooms. But you can be kind, and you can be gracious. You don't have to shun anybody. You can love those who have sinned against you. Now, you can't participate in their sin. You know, it might be that if your child is marrying an unbeliever, that you couldn't in good conscience give your child away. You know, the things that would be limits. If you're not real thrilled about things, it's kind of like the ideal, okay, and awful. And, you know, how invested you are in the wedding. And, you know, if you're really thrilled about what's happening, it's going to be the storybook wedding that you dreamed of. And if the whole thing is really against your desire, you may go, and it's going to be much more simple than that. But I think it takes a lot not to go. I think if you don't go, you better make sure that's not because your feelings are hurt and your control has been lost, but because you're convinced from the Bible you have some biblical reason. And I don't think there are many biblical reasons that you can't go. Be sure it's not because you're mad because you didn't get your way. That's what I see usually happens. Similarly, relationships with in-law. Realizing Genesis 2:24, the relationship has changed even more. And I've also been seeing cases of married couples, young married couples, when they feel like the in-law, their parents or their in-laws are trying to control them, that alienation takes place again. Now it's the young couple who are shunning his parents or her parents. And again, if you were extremely disapproving and they think you hate one of them, they're not going to want to be around you. And you have to realize that, you know, there's something that Peacemakers talks about. It's called passport. Just like you need a passport to get into a country now, you can't just cross borders as an American citizen. You need a passport that gets you in, if you don't have the passport. Well, to talk to an adult child and to give them counsel, you need a passport. You need to show them that you love them. You need to be humble. You need to be relational. You need to be Christ-like so that you get permission to come in. Rather than just saying, well, I'm your parent and I'm going to tell you what I think and you've got to listen because you're my child. A 27-year-old married son or son-in-law is not going to respond well to that. You have to earn the right to be heard when your kids are adults. It just doesn't come automatically. And if you demand to be heard, you can demand for your 5-year-old to hear you. I think even then you might get in trouble ultimately if you do it in a sinful way. But once your kids are adults, you have to gain the right to be heard by them by how you act and how you treat them. And there are many cases in which somebody's shutting you out. And that's where, go back, get the beam out of your own eye. Where have I sinned? Can you tell me where I've sinned? Try to restore the relationship. All the stuff in the Peacemaker material applies here. What if your child's in a bad marriage? Don't go to war against the other side. You want to try to, just all the wonderful things we've been hearing about saving marriages from divorce. You want to be a peacemaker there as well. You know, I loved in Jessica's testimony where she had been told, look at the things about your husband, even in common grace, that are good. Learn to be a better spouse to your spouse and where you can change rather than, taking their side. And yes, you're my child, you're right, he's a monster. That's destructive. And if your adult child remains single, the Bible says singleness is allowed. Maybe they're not ready yet. And again, they know you want them to get married. You never have to tell them again, right? You may not have a passport there either. I don't really have time for the grandchildren part today. It's coming out next year. I'm willing to stay after a few minutes to answer questions, but I've filled up my time. One thing I want you to see from this, I guess two things I want you to take away. One is how when the 2 Timothy 3:16 and 17 tells us the Bible is sufficient, that it equips us for every good work, that even a subject that maybe you came and think, well, what can the Bible say about dealing with your adult kids? That there are a lot of passages in the Bible that talk about that. And the Bible, the principles in the Bible are sufficient to help us face every part of life. And the other would be, since such a theme of this conference has been peacemaking through the gospel, that the gospel has to permeate our relationships with our adult kids. And many parents are relating to their kids according to law and harshness. And all they're doing is alienating their adult kids. Now, you heard me in the beginning. I'm not saying enable them in their foolishness. You can be kind without enabling. You can be gracious without being enabling. But we want them to see through us the grace and the love of Christ. Surprise them. When they do what they know is breaking your heart, and you're still kind to them and love them and want to be with them, that's going to speak a lot of gospel to them. Let's pray. Father in heaven, we thank you for your word, which is sufficient to help us with every need and every problem. Help us as parents and counselors to face these situations. And again, we long to see our children walking with you. But we confess that in many ways, we've been guilty sometimes of driving them away through our sinfulness. Help us to live out the gospel in relationship to our kids, that you may be glorified. We pray in Jesus' name. Amen.